This is a story about how the natural world lets us know that something is wrong. Whether or not we choose to pay attention to it, of course, is a very different question. The story begins in British Columbia with a pretty rare type of fish. Along the way, it raises questions that are best answered by a close examination of our mining practices. And the story ends, well, it hasn't yet, but it ends up miles and miles away, across the United States border in Montana, where officials started wondering what the hell we're doing up in the mountains across the border. This sounds so cliche to say, especially during a week about the environment. But of course, we are all connected. It still seems like it takes us a lot longer than it should, though, to realize that problems with a little fish will eventually cause problems with our own drinking water and with our own neighbors. So maybe we should do something about that before it's too late. It is the kind of lesson that you'd think we'd have learned by now, right? I mean, you would think, and yet, here we are. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story, and this is part four of our special five-part series with the narwhal. We are joined by Carol Linnett, who is a journalist there and also the managing editor of the narwhal. Hello, Carol.
Hi, Jordan.
Why don't you start your story, which is fascinating and also a little scary, by telling me a little bit about the West Slope cutthroat trout.
Sure thing. So the West Slope cutthroat trout are a very beautiful fish. They have pink cheeks and adorable little spots, and they're affectionately known in certain areas in British Columbia as cutties. People flock to this valley in southeastern British Columbia to a little town called Fernie in search of these adorable cutties. I've been told that they are the perfect fish for fly fishers. It's like they sit under the water and they're just waiting to gobble up a fly. But what's been happening in Fernie over the last couple of years has been pretty distressing for not just fly fishermen, but for locals who live there and for conservation organizations, which is that increasingly fish are being pulled out of the water with some distressing deformities.
Like what kind of deformities? What physical changes have locals seen in them?
So some of the things that people are seeing are deformed jaws. So the jaws, you know, the bottom jaw will be jutting out far to the left and not connect to the top jaw at all. Another thing they're seeing are deformed spines, so really intense curvature of the spine, which obviously for a fish would make it quite hard to swim. Probably the worst one, I think, in my mind is missing gill plates. So fish on the sides of their sort of cheek area have these soft, fleshy covers that cover their gills. And the gills are like, if you could imagine, imagine your fingers had no skin on them, just really fleshy little fingers. This is critical to fish essentially being able to breathe in water. And they're actually missing the plates that cover these very sensitive and fragile gills. So they're kind of swimming in the water with their gills completely exposed.
What's causing this?
So the issue in the waterways in this area, sort of the watershed is known as the Elk Valley watershed. And what's been happening over the last few decades is a dramatic increase in levels of selenium. So selenium is you know, a naturally occurring element. It's essential for a healthy life for humans and for animals. But it's I've been told by a scientist who researches selenium and its impacts in ecosystems that it's considered biphasic, which means it's an element that can go from good to you to very bad for you in a very short amount of time. So even subtle increases in selenium can be very distressing, especially to small critters and creatures that live in these watersheds, like little invertebrates and mayflies and birds and fish. The increase in selenium in this watershed is due very undeniably to one thing and one thing only, which is the massive increase in coal mining.
What kind of mining are we talking about? And, you know, how far away is it being done? What's going on up there?
So the coal mines in the Elk Valley are, they're quite an impressive thing in and of themselves. Imagine you have kind of the quintessential vision of like the Canadian Rockies. This is an area of land that's kind of, you know, right up against the border between BC and Alberta, and just above the border of BC and Montana. So you have this like these really impressive, you know, towering mountainous landscapes. And these coal mines are sort of situated up in these mountains. And it's a particular kind of mining that has really taken off in the 90s, which has led to the selenium problem. Mining has been happening in this region for about 100 years, but it was really with the takeoff of mountaintop removal mining that you saw the problem with selenium. So these mines, if you can imagine them, there are five there, and they're all owned by a company called Teck Resources. And if you're to kind of look at this area on Google Maps, even before really scrolling in, if you're just looking at like kind of that broad, you know, high airplane view, you would be able to sort of see them visibly on the landscape. They're absolutely enormous. Some of the biggest mines in the province are here, and they sort of stretch along this contiguous region of mountaintops for about 100 kilometers. And as, you know, kind of your classic vision of mountaintop removal mining, these are huge mountain peaks that are being sort of leveled tier by tier. So they almost look like these huge, gigantic staircases are being sort of carved into the side of these mountains. And as a result of, you know, you're removing a lot of this rock, and that rock, whatever is, you know, high value coal is being taken and moved away for processing. And the rest is just waste rock. And that waste rock gets kind of dumped into these huge piles. And those piles just sit there exposed. They're almost nearly as big as mountains themselves. They're quite enormous. And they just kind of sit there exposed to the elements, to the snow and the wind and the rain, all year long for decades. And this is the root of the selenium problem, is that water flows through these waste rock piles and moves through little tributaries and little rivers and kind of makes its way from the creeks into the main water stem. Every single little bit of that water is pulling a little bit more of selenium along with it into the major waterways.
You said a few minutes ago that it was pretty undeniable that the mining is what's causing the selenium to enter the water. And my first question, I guess, is that confirmed by Teck itself and it's not in dispute? And if so, what kind of regulations govern how much selenium they can pour into waterways?
So that's a really interesting question. To the first part of it, you know, is it contested at all, like where the selenium is coming from? No, that's not a contested fact. Teck Resources, the company itself, has acknowledged that they have some major troubles with water quality, and they're working very hard to deal with the selenium problem. It's not a contested fact by the province, and it's an issue of real concern for the state of Montana. Just last month, Montana actually released a report saying that in the waterway that crosses the BC-Montana border, that 95% of the selenium entering into that waterway is coming directly from the Elk River, which is where all this water from these waste piles around these mines is flowing into. So it's not unknown by any stretch of the imagination that this is a huge problem. In fact, if you kind of rewind all the way back to the 90s, it was already beginning to be recognized then that there was a major problem with selenium. Selenium science itself was developing, you know, between the 90s and the early 2000s because of other mines in other places across the U.S. There was a very famous photo of a two-headed trout that made its way into the New York Times. And this was the result of selenium pollution from a mine down in the States. So this was really concerning for everyone who was watching this issue with these mines and these, you know, these increasing selenium levels in British Columbia. To the question of regulations, the federal government started looking closely at this. You know, it's always interesting when there's kind of a division in who is responsible for what in terms of jurisdictions between, say, the province and the federal government. Well, the province is responsible for the mining of resources and pollution coming from mines. The federal government in the province, the federal government is responsible for protecting fish on behalf of all Canadians. So according to the Fisheries Act, no one gets to pollute fish-bearing waters. at least not willy-nilly. You know, there's going to be very strict regulations. But this is a really interesting thing that I think most Canadians will be quite surprised to hear. There are actually no pollution effluent regulations for coal mines in Canada. So essentially, if you want to permit a mine to mine for copper in British Columbia, there are regulations at the federal level that will say, okay, well, you can't release, you know, XYZ contaminants into any fish-bearing waterways, which essentially, you know, are almost all waterways are fish-bearing in one way or another. And so there's very strict permit requirements and regulations that will be put into effect. So, I mean, if you're running a copper mine, you might be allowed to discharge, you know, a little bit of this, you know, kind of pollutant. But it's going to be very specifically monitored and monitored against limits and levels that are actually written down in existing regulations. Those same existing limits and rules and regulations don't actually exist for coal mines in Canada. And it's not just coal mines, it's actually all non-metal mines. Any mine that isn't mining for metals or diamonds actually does not have these strict regulations. It's kind of a big little scandal.
That seems like a pretty huge loophole.
It's an enormous loophole, and it's really created some interesting and rather awkward problems. And the Elk Valley is certainly one of these. And so the federal government isn't the only body that regulates pollution. Of course, you know, in British Columbia, if we've got the provinces responsible for permitting mines and monitoring pollution, some of those regulations are actually coming down to the provincial level as well. And it gets a little bit awkward there too. The province of BC has, you know, been very hesitant to put specific pollution limits on these mines. And in place of very strict rules and regulations that say, you know, you cannot pollute beyond this level. If you pollute beyond this level, we're going to take away your permits until you can fix that problem. BC's been very hesitant to take that approach. What they've done instead is they've said, let's come up with a plan, you know, they like to call it an adaptive management plan, you know, because who knows, you know, what the future holds, and we might run into these problems, but, you know, through collaboration and monitoring together, we can get there. And it's very loosey-goosey, and basically you don't have a sort of very strict limit.
Right, by design.
Exactly. And what this has, what this looks like for these mines in the Elk Valley, and these are not just, you know, it's not a matter of like, these are just some mines, like if they're really bad at polluting, why can't we just shut them down? These are huge mines that would have massive economic consequences for the communities that live there. There are thousands of people that are employed by these mines. So the province, you know, it does have a strong desire to work with this company to get this problem under wraps. And so basically in this plan, they've come up with working in consultation with, you know, scientists and local communities and the company, is that they need to stabilize selenium pollution levels by 2023. They actually have to start dropping down those pollution levels by 2030, which, you know, in the time when this plan was being developed several years ago, that seemed like something that could be brought, you know, that seemed like an achievable target. But now we're just a mere 3 years away from that goal of stabilizing selenium levels. And what we've seen year after year and decade after decade is a slow, steady uptick in selenium in the watershed. And the company has spent hundreds of millions of dollars investing in these water treatment plants, and none of them thus far have proven to be ultimately successful at taking selenium out of the water. It's a real conundrum.
We started this by talking about fish and putting the trout aside for a minute, not lightly. What other problems come from selenium in the water, especially for humans?
So this is an issue of ongoing concern as well. When I went to the Elk Valley in 2018, I had been hearing rumors before heading up there to do some reporting that the problem of selenium pollution was no longer one of just, you know, the rivers and the fish. It had really crept its way and made its way into the larger water system from which everyone drinks. And sure enough, that we visited the town of Sparwood, and some of these municipal water systems had actually been taken completely offline And people were having water delivered to their homes for drinking. So as I mentioned before, BC doesn't have, you know, that strict limit in place that like really defines, you know, how much selenium can be put into the water. What we do have instead are sort of BC's water quality guidelines. Once again, these are sort of soft. They're not law, so they're not enforceable as law. But according to those guidelines, to keep water safe for human consumption, selenium levels need to be kept down to 10 parts per billion. To keep aquatic life safe, so the fish, it needs to be down to 2 parts per billion. Fish are, they live in the water, obviously. Haven't met a fish who doesn't live in the water yet. And they're incredibly sensitive to this type of pollution and the way that it causes deformities and birth defects. Another issue, you know, with the fish is people are saying, sure, we're pulling fish out of the water that have these really troubling deformities. But what about the fish that we're not seeing at all? And this has been a major ongoing concern, too, is the potential for a fish population collapse. So in the last couple of years, in addition to seeing water systems actually being taken completely offline because the selenium levels are just too high, it's not safe. This is happening in municipal systems and also in some of the local ranches and private properties. You're seeing water wells that are hitting those upper limits of what's considered safe. Another thing that TEC has actually had to report on recently is a fish population collapse of some of these cuddies, these cuddy populations. There's actually one population of this trout that lives above a waterfall. And everyone talks about how they're genetically distinct. They're a very unique population of West Slope cutthroat trout. And that population, this is in a little river that is beneath Tech's biggest mine in the area. That population suffered a 93% collapse. So this is really interesting because as this problem with selenium was sort of gaining some traction and the federal government started to kind of take a look at this, they actually hired an expert, the same expert who took a look at that two-headed trout situation in the States. He actually wrote a report in 2014 for Canada on this exact issue. And he was very, very specific in his warning about what would happen if selenium levels were not got brought under control. And he actually said, this will lead to a collapse of populations of sensitive species like the West Slope cutthroat trout. And it's so harrowing now, just a mere 6 years later, to actually start to see that happening in these fish populations, in these waterways that are directly downstream of these mines.
So the fish are showing up deformed. Some of them are vanishing. Local water is unfit to drink in some places. Why isn't this a bigger deal? Why aren't more people talking about this? It seems like it should be a massive scandal.
I agree with you. It's such a big story. It has, every time I find myself talking about it, people are kind of like, wow, is this like such an Aaron Brockovich kind of story? And it has elements, you know, the story has a lot of those features to it. You know, in some ways, it's a really slow moving catastrophe, this problem with selenium. It's just been inching up over decades. And it's very hard to, you know, kind of command people's undivided attention for decades. And this is a problem with a lot of, you know, big environmental stories. And as environmental journalists, you want to find a way to capture and tell these stories in a way that really does justice to the urgency and the stakes. So I think a part of it is it's just like such a long-term, slow-moving catastrophe. I do think that another part of the challenge with this issue is that it, you know, the story really devolves quite quickly into sort of regulatory
jargon.
Exactly. And we're talking about, you know, the water quality plan and monitoring and parts per billion. And you can sort of feel people's eyes glazing over just at the thought of it.
Sure. But what about the people who live there? Why aren't they raising the alarm? Why aren't they talking about it? I mean, their water is no longer fit to drink.
So this is a major, major part of this issue, too. A lot of the people who are immediately impacted by this issue as an environmental issue and a potential health concern, these people also work at these mines. And they are reliant on these mines for their income. And their dads worked at the mines and their moms work at the mine. And They plan on working at the mine. You know, there's people up in this area that they don't even bother finishing high school because they know exactly where they're going to work. They know that it's confirmed. And Tech has done a lot of work to demonstrate its commitment to the community and its desire to work on a solution. The company, you know, everything is branded with Tech when you're up there. You know, if you see kids playing soccer on a soccer field, they're all wearing jerseys that have the Tech logo on it. Tech is really, really involved in the community. And to the extent that the company can be, it has leveraged enormous political capital as well. It seems like, you know, a piece of history already, the fact that for a long time, BC was an outlier in all of Canada because it didn't limit political contributions from corporations to political parties. True. It was just a few years ago that was, sort of outlawed. Prior to that, Tech Resources was the number one donor to the BC Liberal Party in the province. And the BC Liberal Party was in power for 16 straight years. And those are 16 straight years in which these mines were getting new permits, they were growing, and they were increasing. So there was maybe not a lot of incentive on a political level for the province to really sort of put limitations on this company and the way that it operates. So I think that's another part of the challenge too, is that this company is enormously influential, not just there with the people who live and work at these mines who are hesitant. Certainly I experienced this reporting from on the ground there. You know, I resorted to door knocking because I couldn't get anyone to talk to me. I was trying to set up interviews. I was trying to gain access to people and no one wanted to speak about this issue. So I ended up going to Sparwood, a community where, you know, the vast majority of people work for the mine in one fashion or another. And I just knocked on people's doors asking if they'd speak to me. And I was just striking out. No one wanted to talk about this. And some people said straight up, like, I can't talk to you about this. Like, I will get in trouble.
So what happens going forward then if not much changes? Are we hoping that Tech can bring this under control? Is anybody planning to regulate them more strongly? The BC NDP perhaps? What are the next steps here?
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts right now that will sort of determine the fate and the outcome of this issue and these mines and this watershed. One of the things that is a huge, I think, a high pressure piece is that since 2015, BC and Montana. So this pollution is as much as it's a slow moving crisis for the Elk Valley, all of this water drains directly into the Kookanoosa Reservoir, which crosses the border of BC and Montana. And we're starting to hear more and more and more from politicians, conservation groups, fly fishers, and just locals in Montana who are pretty upset that selenium levels are now getting higher and higher in their waterway because of this problem. So since 2015, BC and Montana have been saying, okay, we are going to get a system in place. We're going to decide on a shared aligned limit for selenium in the Kookanoosa Reservoir, in that body of water that crosses the border. And the deadline that they agreed to for that was the end of 2020. And so just recently, Montana, you know, came out and they said, okay, we're going to say out loud, like, what our limit is. It's 0.8 parts per billion. And measurements have already been taken that have that waterway showing levels as high as 0.6 parts per billion. So it's like very, very close to this limit already. And BC has basically declined to say what their proposed limit is going to be. The other thing that is a major pressure point is that Tech has proposed a whole new mine. They don't consider it a whole new mine because it's beside an existing mine. So they're calling it a mine expansion. This is an issue that is contentious in and of itself because a lot of onlookers say the company is clearly intentionally designating this new mine as an expansion because the requirements for triggering certain environmental assessments changed, whether it's, you know, just an expansion of an existing mine or a whole new mine. But just very recently, the federal government said, whether it's a new mine or an expansion, we're going to do a federal environmental assessment of, you know, looking at this issue, looking at this proposed mine expansion. And if the federal government is doing a full environmental review of this new mine, they're going to have to take into account these selenium problems. And that's going to shine a spotlight on this problem and how the growth of mines is adding to this issue as well. And in addition to this new tech mine, there are three other companies who are angling to get mines in here too. So there's actually three separate coal proposals from three separate companies that are also looking to get in on the coal action in the Elk Valley.
Well, until the government shines a light on it, thank you for helping us shine a light on it.
It's my pleasure. And we've got ample reporting on this subject. So for anyone who's curious, please check out the Narwhal. We've got quite a lot on the subject.
Carol Linnett is the managing editor of the Narwhal. And you can find the Narwhal at thenarwhal.ca. That's thenarwhal.ca. You can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. I am not going to spell that for you. You can figure it out. You can also find us at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter, and you can find us in your favorite podcast player. I don't care which one you use, but if it lets you review us, you better do it. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.